Last month on the show, we ran a program called Happy Station's Tribute to DXers, which was a very successful show. And because there's so many other things that I couldn't include in that program, we're going to do a second one very, very soon. So stay tuned to the show, and I will announce the date for that. Now, we're going to bring you a little bit of a teaser, shall we say, of that upcoming program with a long conversation that I had with Jerry Berg in the USA. We spoke for almost 45 minutes, but we'll bring a little excerpt right now. For those who don't know the name, because he is very well known within shortwave circles, he has authored three books. The first one entitled On the Shortwaves, 1923 to 1945. The second one, Listening to the Shortwaves, 1945 to today, and Broadcasting on the Shortwaves, 1945 to today. So now let's take a listen to an excerpt of that long conversation that I had with Jerry Berg. Jerry, the three books that you wrote about shortwave radio are absolutely fascinating. Before we get to the content of the books, where did you come up with the idea to do this? Was this something you just woke up one day and said, you know, I'm going to write a book about international radio?
No, it didn't really happen that way. This kind of goes back to 1986 when a couple of things happened. In 86, a group of DXers here in the United States got together and decided that we wanted to set up a group to preserve QSL cards for historical reasons, and I was put in charge of that. And so pretty soon we started receiving QSLs from old-timers in the hobby, and it was apparent that these were QSLs from stations that many of us had really never heard of before. So I became interested in the history of shortwave that way. And about the same time, a local group formed here in New England called the New England Antique Radio Club. It was mainly for people who were interested in antique radio equipment. But I attended one of their swap and sell meets up in New Hampshire, and I bought myself a box of old radio magazines. And in those magazines were copies of Radio News, which had a great shortwave column. And I was reading about stations that I had never heard of, had never heard mentioned by others in the DXing hobby. And that's how it all started. I started collecting magazines and various shortwave memorabilia, and over a period of years, I collected quite a bit of that stuff. And it just became apparent to me some years later that nobody had ever told this story before, and I had enough material along with some academic stuff that had been published on the subject to put the first book together back in 1999. So that's how it all started.
Were you a shortwave listener before that?
Yes, I've been a shortwave listener since 1958.
Right.
But as I said, this historical stuff just wasn't in evidence. I mean, nobody really knew much about shortwave history before the time that they entered the hobby, and I was no different.
So when you started working on the first book, because you had all this material, was it difficult to decide what to put in the book? Because the first book covers the 1920s to the 1940s, which at that period there was a lot happening in radio just before and at the early part of the Second World War.
It wasn't difficult because I was writing, it was difficult to sort of physically handle the material, but deciding what to include wasn't all that difficult because I was writing the book primarily for people in the radio listening community. This wasn't intended to be an academic work. And I knew what they liked because I knew what I liked, and they liked the same things. DXers enjoy reading about QSL cards and receivers and stations and all of that. So I pretty much knew what the content ought to be, and I was able to put the books together with that in mind.
So when you were putting the books together, did you have in mind also to write two other books after that, or was the first one just a one-time thing?
It was a one-time thing. I had no plans to write the later books because I thought that there would be other people who were more experienced than I with regard to the years after after 1945, and I thought would be able to do a better job, frankly. So I never really thought about the post-1945 period at all when I was writing the first book. But a number of people said to me they enjoyed the first book, and they said, you know, you ought to really continue this story. And I did have a tremendous amount of material for the years after 1945, and frankly, nobody else wrote it up, and it seemed to be out there kind of waiting to happen, so I just decided to do it. And of course, I was also aided by the fact that I retired in 2003, so I was able to spend a lot of time at this that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
When you were writing the first book, did you have access to people that were around at the time radio was king and shortwave radio was taking off?
Some, but not many, because most of those folks were gone. I mean, they were themselves part of history by the time I was writing this. I did have the advantage of having a good deal of material from some of those folks. I was able to contact some of them. Some of the material came through our Committee to Preserve Radio Verifications. And so I had a lot of written material from that time. But there weren't too many people around to kind of ask firsthand impressions of. And I've also discovered that lots of those firsthand impressions aren't necessarily accurate. We don't always remember things accurately. And my experience has been that you pretty much have to rely on the written word to get your facts straight. And even there, you can't always be 100% sure.
When you started writing the second book, which picks up after the period after the Second World War, at the beginning of the Cold War, I mean, the Cold War period was a very interesting time for international radio, was it not?
Yeah, it was a tremendously interesting time, and frankly, I'm of the view that it was the Cold War years that kept shortwave going for a long, long time. Many of the large international stations increased their power largely out of the radio competition of the Cold War. A lot of smaller countries wanted to be kind of represented at the table. They wanted their voices heard. So lots of shortwave countries and lots of shortwave stations came on the air. And I think if you really sort of dig deep enough, you find that it was the Cold War that was really what started that expansion of shortwave, and things just sort of continued on by themselves until 1988, 1990, when things changed in the Soviet Union.
Well, what is actually quite fascinating is just around the time when the Second World War ended, broadcasters like the Voice of America, BBC, oh, at the time I think it was still called the Empire Service,
yeah,
and the CBC International Service, after the war they started to drop languages because they thought, oh, it's not important anymore. And a lot of people have mentioned to me that if the Cold War had not happened, international broadcasting would probably just disappeared, like with many other things from that period.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I really do. The Cold War kept things heated up, and of course, this was a relatively easy way to for each side to reach into the other, and that dynamic brought a lot of smaller countries along with it. Of course, it also brought mm-hmm. some things that weren't so great, like jamming, which was a real scourge during the Cold War. We still have jamming today. The Chinese broadcast kind of place their Chinese musical signals in a lot of places where they don't belong, but it's nothing like the jamming was back in the 50s and the 60s.
When I first started listening to shortwave on a regular basis, for myself, my own personal story behind it was that an uncle of mine had a shortwave radio, and he was buying a new one, and he gave me his old set, and I was tuning around going, oh, this is interesting. What language are they speaking? And, oh, this is interesting to listen to a show from Sweden and stuff like that. So that's how I started listening. I was never really a DXer. I was never really the type that would try to tune stations that were not even targeted to, say, Canada, or didn't even have enough power to reach Canada most of the time. I was just tuning in because I thought it was interesting. But one thing I remember very much was, especially in the late 70s and early 80s when I was doing a lot more listening than I am now, is the amount of stations on the air. It was just incredible. And especially like Radio Moscow, for example. I mean, Radio Moscow had a frequency every 10 to 15 kilohertz, it seemed like.
No question. I mean, Radio Moscow was everywhere, as was the BBC, maybe not quite to the extent of Radio Moscow. But yeah, the bands were full. I mean, the high bands were full of international stations, and for those who DX the smaller stations, the lower frequencies, the tropical bands were just jammed full of stations. Every 5 kilohertz there was a station. There were dozens and dozens of stations in places like Colombia and Venezuela, whereas today there might be one or two. So there's no question that the high point of shortwave is long past us now.
And I was speaking there with Jerry Berg, the author of three books on the shortwave, 1923 to 1945, listening to the shortwave, 1945 to today, and broadcasting on the shortwave, 1945 to today. And for our second program in the series, Happy Stations Tribute to DXers, will bring you that full conversation. And for that show, one lucky person will be a winner of a copy of each of the books. So stay tuned for an announcement for that program. All right. Now, a few weeks ago on the show, my guest was Jerry Berg. Now, Jerry has written three books on international broadcasting. The first one was called On the Shortwave, 1923 to 1945. And the second one, Listening on the Shortwave, 1945 to today. And then the third book called Broadcasting on the Shortwave, 1945 to today. Now, Jerry is a well-respected shortwave listener and expert on international shortwave broadcasting. The three books, by the way, are available from McFarland Publishing, their website I'll give out at the end of the show. But then let's move on to the remainder of the conversation that I had with Jerry. And I wanted to ask him at one point about the golden age, because we hear about, for example, the golden age of cinema, the golden age of television, and there's also a golden age of radio. But what about the golden age of shortwave radio?
I think there are sort of two golden ages, I guess. There are some people who would say that the golden age was really the 1930s, when shortwave was just coming into its own, and some people had great hopes for shortwave. People thought that it was going to replace medium wave broadcasting altogether, and that listening to international shortwave was going to become commonplace. That never happened, of course, but there was a good deal of hope back then. In more modern times, yeah, I would say the golden age of shortwave was probably the 1970s. By that time, we were long out of the experimental period. Stations were coming on the air right and left. There were tons of stations in South America and Indonesia and all kinds of out-of-the-way places. And none of the big broadcasters had started cutting back yet. And so mm-hmm. in terms of how much there was to listen to and how interesting it was, yeah, I would say that was sort of the second golden age.
Would you say, I mean, in your own personal view, the difficulty that, let's say, shortwave has had, especially in the last maybe 20 years, was bad promotion of shortwave as a viable broadcast medium?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. There are a lot of people that are always sort of puzzling about why things are the way they are. I don't know if it was bad promotion, although there certainly was bad promotion. Really, there was very little promotion. One of the realities of international shortwave broadcasting is that most of these services are really, really very low budget, with a few exceptions, are very low budget shoestring kinds of operations, and they're not driven by the same kind of commercial dynamics that private radio stations are. So that has always been a problem. But you know, the reality is that shortwave has really I won't say always been an invisible medium, but for a very long time it's been an invisible medium. And there are some folks who feel that if you only talk it up and get people interested in it and tell them what's on shortwave, they would find it interesting and more people would listen. But somehow it's just never worked that way. So I don't know that you can lay it principally at the feet of those who weren't promoting shortwave, but there's no question that there really wasn't much promotion, and whatever advantages might have been gained by increased promotion were never realized.
Something about international broadcasting that I always found very fascinating, and you talk about him in your book, is a well-known Voice of America broadcaster by the name of Willis Conover.
Yeah.
And, you know, it amazes me. I've talked to Americans who work in the jazz industry who had never heard of him. But on a few occasions when I've been to Eastern Europe and I've mentioned to people the name Willis Conover, he was like a celebrity almost.
Yeah, it's really a testament to, the power of shortwave, that you could have a shortwave personality that could have that kind of impact in such a broad part of the world, while at the same time being completely unknown here in the United States. It's a good example.
So when you finished book two, was that, did you say to yourself, okay, that's the end of it, I've done two, I've covered everything I can? Then you wrote the third one. What happened?
Well, actually, broadcasting and listening were written at about the same time. They were released at the same time, so as I was writing one, I was also working on the other. The broadcasting book, which is largely a year by year presentation of what was on the air, I thought was necessary because there really wasn't anything like it available. And my own view was that once shortwave had I don't want to say disappeared, but once it had gotten to the point where really only the most devoted people were listening to it, there would be no record of what had gone before. And that's why I wrote the broadcasting book. It wasn't intended to be an exhaustive treatment of every station that was on the air and their respective histories. It was intended to be, and I think it is, a pretty good picture of what you could hear on shortwave each year from 1945 on, whether you are interested in international broadcasting or interested in DXing the smaller stations. It just seemed to me that there ought to be a record of this, and so that's why I put that together.
You know, the other thing that I find quite fascinating is, of all broadcast mediums, it seems that shortwave has gone through probably the biggest change, even more so than medium wave or FM, or digital audio broadcasting. But shortwave itself, I mean, when you think today in 2009, it is nothing even it's nothing compared to what it was 20 years ago, let alone even 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. There's no question about it. It's viewed now, unfortunately, as a legacy system, a legacy technology, although one that gets pressed into service when other things tend to fail. And yet, at the same time, there are people who are trying to improve it. The whole digital shortwave movement, although it hasn't taken off to the degree that some folks would have liked, is kind of interesting because it brings the notion of FM quality or high fidelity quality reception to shortwave. That's something that, of course, could never have been imagined not too many years ago.
You know, I heard a quote recently from someone, and he said to me that if shortwave had been invented now, this year, he said people would be going gaga over it, to think that you can have a transmitter in one country and reach another country, but because it's from the Marconi era, about 100 years ago, it's considered outdated old technology.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, the magic of shortwave has never really been, at least for sort of the devoted shortwave listener, the magic of shortwave has never really been on the program side. It has always been on the side of the medium. The notion that you can turn on your shortwave receiver and hear a station from the other side of the world with nothing between you and them, except for the ionosphere, it is really quite remarkable. And of course, that's different from using the internet, where you can get, you know, crystal clear programming now from virtually any place in the world. But you're connected by wires, so you kind of expect that quality of program. But in shortwave, it's kind of the magic of the distance, I think, that really has kept shortwave listeners interested over the years.
Would you say then that this could be a transitional period for shortwave radio, that we're right now we're in this period of where the media is going from what it was to almost disappearing to coming back in some way, shape, or form?
Oh, for sure. The form that it's coming back into or morphing into is least time broadcasting. I mean, the number of new radio stations that come on the air today, new shortwave stations, is very small. If you define a shortwave station as a transmitter and some program production capability, what organizations do now if they want to use shortwave is that they rent time over one of the big international broadcasters, BBC, Germany. There are a variety of transmitter sites around the world that essentially broker their time. They sell their time to most anybody that is interested in buying it. So as a result, you can be a small organization with not much more than a tape recorder and not too much money in the bank, and you can buy time through one of these big transmitter houses. And you can put your signal out worldwide, whereas if you had to develop your own transmitting capability, which used to be the rule, there would be no way that you could get on the air. So as a result, you have a lot of different kinds of organizations coming on shortwave. They're not typically broadcasting all day or for many hours a day. Oftentimes they're only an hour or two a week or something like that. But nonetheless, they're interesting programmatic targets, even though they may not constitute real DX to shortwave listeners who are looking for that. So that's the way things have gone, and it may well be that there's enough of that business to keep a small number of high power transmitter operators in business. But I certainly don't see any trend back to the good old days, so to speak, when it was new stations with new transmitters. Those days seem to be over.
And I was speaking there with Jerry Berg, the author of three books on the shortwaves, 1923 to 1945, listening on the shortwaves, 1945 to today, and broadcasting on the shortwaves, 1945 to today. The books are available from McFarland Publishing. Their website is www.mcfarlandpub.com. That's mcfarlandpub.com. And I will be giving away a copy of all three books to one